Stay tuned for Nightline Africa, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
Dozens of Turkish hostages freed after being kidnapped by Islamic State militants and a lockdown in Sierra Leone to fight Ebola. I'm Marty Johnson reporting from Washington. Turkey's prime minister says 49 Turkish hostages seized by Islamic State militants in Iraq in June are back in Turkey safe. The state-run Anadolu news agency reports no ransom was paid, no conditions accepted, but it does not say where it got that information. Dorian Jones reports from Istanbul.
The Turkish foreign ministry says all 49 Turkish hostages held by Islamic State are in good condition. Turkish Prime Minister Ahmet Davutoğlu, who cut short a visit to Azerbaijan, said the release was a result of a protracted process. Mr. Davutoğlu said after days and weeks of intense work, Turkish officials returned their citizens to Turkey early in the morning. President Erdogan, in his statement, paid tribute to Turkey's intelligence service, saying through patience and dedication they had performed a rescue operation. Dorian Jones, VOA News, Istanbul.
The British-based Syrian Observatory for Human Rights says more than 300 Kurdish fighters from Turkey are now in Syria to defend a Kurdish area against Islamic State militants. Thousands of Syrian Kurds fled. Iraq's foreign minister, Ibrahim al-Jafari, told the United Nations Security Council his country should shoulder the burden of ground combat against Islamic State militants within its borders, but also encouraged a continued air campaign from international allies. The streets of Freetown, Sierra Leone's capital, resemble a ghost town today. It is day two of a three-day lockdown to find hidden cases of Ebola and stop the spread of the deadly disease. Tens of thousands of healthcare workers are going door to door in the West African country, informing people of how to avoid Ebola and asking suspected patients to come in for treatment. This is VOA News. President Ernest Bai Koroma has appealed to all Sierra Leoneans to stay home during the lockdown, saying the televised address that extraordinary times require extraordinary measures. Critics say the exercise could be chaotic and ineffective. African children are facing disproportionately high levels of violence, according to a new report from the African Policy Forum. The study calls for more coordinated action to prevent violence against children. Martha Vandewolf reports from Addis Ababa.
The new report, released Thursday, says African children are subjected to extremely high levels of emotional, physical, and sexual abuse, and current laws and policies have not been able to tackle this issue. The report is a combination of 75 studies and surveys undertaken in Ethiopia, Kenya, Malawi, Mali, Morocco, Uganda, Zambia, and Zimbabwe. The findings show that in some countries, such as Mali and Zambia, children receive the majority of physical punishment from family members. But in others, such as Togo and Sierra Leone, most of the violence comes from teachers and classmates. Marta van der Wolf for VOA News, Addis Ababa.
Participants in Ukrainian peace talks have agreed to create a buffer zone to separate Ukrainian government troops and pro-Russian separatists. Under the deal reached today in Minsk, each side must pull back its artillery positions 15 kilometers to allow a 30-kilometer buffer zone. The agreement, negotiated by representatives of Ukraine, Russia, the separatists, and the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe, aims to reinforce a September 5th ceasefire agreement. Afghan election officials say they will release results tomorrow, having completed an audit of ballots cast in the June 4th election. The announcement will bring an end to the country's more than five-month-long election process. Both candidates, Abdullah Abdullah and Ashraf Ghani Ahmazadeh, claim victory. They have been negotiating a power-sharing agreement to divide the responsibilities. Abdullah won the most of votes in the initial election, but did not manage a majority, forcing a second vote, which Ghani won. Scotland's vote of no on its independence referendum was greeted with relief in much of Britain and many other countries. President Barack Obama congratulated Scotland on its full, energetic exercise of democracy, saying through debate, discussion, and passionate yet peaceful deliberations, they reminded the world of Scotland's enormous contributions to the UK and the world. A new campaign in the United States to raise awareness about sexual assault kicked off Friday with a boost from President Barack Obama, who emphasized individual responsibility in preventing the crime on college campuses. An estimated 1 in 5 American women attending college are sexual assault victims. How the college campuses handle these cases is under scrutiny around the United States. I'm Marty Johnson reporting from Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of The Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clawty.
Particularly at a time when the Malian government and armed groups are looking for ways to find a lasting solution to this conflict. So it's that sympathy for the families of the victims and also the total rejection and condemnation of these attacks.
The African Union mission to Mali and the Sahel condemns latest bomb attack on UN peacekeepers from Chad.
What has come out strongly is that we need to do things more better. We were able to sit back and evaluate our performance, see what we did right, and also try to look at what we could have done better.
Kenya marks 1 year anniversary of the terrorist attack at the Westgate shopping mall.
We'll be calling on them to make sure they help new farmers and villagers, especially those around here producing milk. Otherwise, they will lose their land. Of course, we will lose the milk, but they will also lose the land. We want to share knowledge with our people.
And Zimbabwe minister threatens remaining white commercial farmers. We'll have details. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. The African Union's mission to Mali and the Sahel says it is ready to provide assistance to launch an investigation into the latest bomb attack that killed five United Nations peacekeepers from Chad. Issaka Suwari, special advisor to the AU mission head Pierre Buyoya, condemned the attack. He also called for the ongoing peace talks between the government in Bamako and armed groups to be expedited in order to restore law and order in the northern part of the West African country. Suwari told me earlier that an investigation could establish a clear distinction between the armed groups who want peace and those who just want to create chaos and instability in Mali.
First is our thoughts with the families of those killed and the Chadian people, because as you rightly said, this is not the first time. There have been several attacks targeting them in their area, and many of them have died, of course, because of this. So our thoughts are with the families, regretting and expressing our sympathies with them. Secondly is to condemn with the highest energy possible on these attacks, because this is not tolerable, particularly at a time when the Malian government and armed groups are busy looking for ways to find a lasting solution to this conflict. So it's that sympathy for the families of the victims and also the total rejection and condemnation of these attacks.
Has the mission launched an investigation into this latest round of attacks? And what is the AU mission doing about this?
Well, as you know, the troops are under the command of the United Nations through its mission in Mali, MINUSMA. So the AU doesn't have a direct role with regard to what happens about the military contingents on the ground. But of course, because we have military advisors and we do work collaboratively with the MINUSMA, we will be happy to provide any assistance with regard to the investigation to go to the bottom of these recurrent attacks targeting what we consider soldiers of peace.
What does this make of the ongoing talks between those armed groups and the government, since, you know, the UN is playing a significant role in trying to ensure there's peace and law and order restored in that part of the country, which is part of your mission as well?
That is correct, but you know, there is a division of labor. Until the transformation of the African-led international mission for Mali, AFISMA, in July last year, we had direct responsibility for all these issues happening because we had the control over the military contingent, the police, as well as the civilian. Since that transformation, the military and the police role have gone to the UN. But because we have a mandate also to deal with the security situation, we do work with the UN on the security issues through various mechanisms that have been put in place, as well as through our Nouakchott process that aims to bring about a collaborative work between the countries of the region, because our view, and this is not contradicted by any other observer, is that given the enormity of the challenges being faced by the countries, none of them on its own can face the gamut of challenges that are there. So they must collaborate. So we work on the security issues from this perspective.
So what is next following this unfortunate attacks that possibly some people suggest might continue because these people who launch these attacks keep continuing that, you know, wantonly?
That is true. That is why it is necessary to have the peace process concluding with a peace agreement so that we know now that these armed groups, because you have various types of armed elements in the region, you have those that are only engaged in terrorist activities, and you have those that seem to have a political agenda. I think these are the ones that are now at the negotiating table in Algiers. So once we get a peace agreement with these groups, the space will be a bit clearer, such that we would know now that those that are now engaging in these activities are only criminal and terrorist elements that must be sought and fought by all means. So that is why it's very, very important that a peace agreement is found and quickly so that we can make this necessary.
The Issaka Sowore, special advisor to the AU mission head, Pierre Buyoya. He spoke with me from Mali's capital, Bamako. Uganda's President Yoweri Museveni has named Ruhakana Rugunda as prime minister after dismissing close associate and former prime minister Amama Mbabazi. Some analysts say Mbabazi, the secretary general of the ruling National Resistance Movement, was dismissed for harboring ambitions to succeed Museveni. For more, we have Charles Bichachi, managing editor at the Daily Monitor, an independent Ugandan newspaper, live on the phone. Hello, Charles.
Yes, hello.
What do Ugandans make of the dismissal of Mr. Mbabazi?
Many Ugandans have been wondering when this would happen. And because it has been long in coming. And yesterday's dismissal by the president of his prime minister has been received with mixed reactions. Many people are wondering what the game plan is of the president. He's at this moment, having taken so long to act against somebody who has really stretched his hand. So people are waiting with apprehension, waiting to see what is the next move of Mr. Mbabazi and what is the president's next move. Is he going to reshuffle the entire cabinet to get out some of the ministers who have been perceived to be leaning to Mr. Mbabazi, or will he stop at that action?
What culminated into Mbabazi's dismissal?
I think what the events of 2 weeks ago seemed to have pushed the president to move a little faster on Mr. Mbabazi. Mr. Mbabazi has openly opposed the president's attempt to be the sole candidate of the party in 2016. He has said that the resolution of the caucus is not binding. He has not expressed openly his desire to stand for the party ticket, but he has said the president's attempt to be a sole candidate is illegal. Over the last few weeks, a lot of youth have been coming out on the streets with T-shirts proclaiming Mr. Mbabazi as a presidential candidate for 2016. During a football match between Uganda and Guinea last week in the National Stadium, when power went off suddenly, when power came back, there were several youth with the T-shirts announcing Babaji's presidential bid. So I think these events have showed that Babaji is perhaps getting bolder in his attempts to challenge the president. And I think the president decided that it was time to draw the line.
Now, he still holds the position of General Secretary of the ruling NRM party. Is this the end of Mbabazi's political adventure of wanting to become the president of Uganda?
This is certainly not the end. When the party caucus passed a resolution, many thought that was the end of Mr. Mbabazi. It wasn't the end. When the president addressed the caucus and brought tapes that allegedly of Mbabazi trying to mobilize people for the presidency, many thought that was the end. This is certainly not the end, because Mr. Mbabazi remains the party secretary general, and that the president can't dismiss him. It all now depends on how Mr. Mbabazi chooses to play his next card.
Wouldn't this undermine the dominance of the ruling party in future elections based on how he plays his cards?
Yes, definitely, because the opposition has come out. Dr. Kizza Besigye, who is President Museveni's long nemesis, has come out and said they have been having discussion with Mr. Mbabazi. Many people in the opposition are welcoming Mr. Mbabazi to join them. If Mbabazi chooses to continue operating within the NRM party to undermine President Museveni, he can tip the balance against the president, because then the president will not have a solid political vehicle to push his political bid for 2016. In that case, the president will have to be forced to either act and get Mr. Mbabazi out of the party, which may result in the breaking of the party. And at that point, I think the party will definitely lose a lot of political traction.
Thank you very much, Charles, for speaking with the Voice of America News.
Thank you.
Charles Bichachi is managing editor at the Daily Monitor, an independent Uganda newspaper. He was speaking from the capital, Kampala. Security forces in Kenya have been blamed for an unorganized response to last year's terrorist attack on the Westgate shopping mall in Nairobi and for failing to heed security warnings ahead of time. 1 year after that deadly siege, security experts say nothing has changed. For VOA, Mohammed Yusuf reports from Nairobi.
Charity Irungu lost her husband of 19 years at Westgate when terrorists stormed the shopping mall, killing at least 67 people and wounding hundreds of others. Irungu's husband survived the first phase of the attack when gunmen from Somalia's Islamist group Al-Shabaab sprayed bullets at shoppers and diners. The kindergarten teacher says her husband was killed by Kenyan security forces during the last 2 days of the four-day siege. She says she received a call from him in the wee hours of Sunday, and he said he was safe hiding somewhere.
Still on the same, there's a lady we were looking for our husband together in Oshawa. And for her, she was written a message by the husband on Monday saying he's hiding somewhere in the code room for Nakumat. But we found them both with my husband at the city mortuary, who were killed by KDF. There's something maybe they saw them doing which was not correct. Because, in fact, one of his eyes was spoiled.
The mother of two says she and the other lady asked mortuary staff when the bodies were brought in, but no one was willing to provide information. It is hard to verify the claims of Irungu, but security agencies were blamed for a delayed and unorganized response to the attack that may have cost lives. Security analyst Andrew Franklin tells VOA the country's security agencies were confused and lacked skills and the command structure to combat the attackers.
There was confusion among the government agencies, the Kenya Defense Forces, who should have been in a supporting role, if any role at all, at Westgate, took over the entire scene. The police presence was essentially thrown out of the scene, and they went away. In fact, the entire operation was conducted in violation of Kenyan law.
A parliamentary inquiry said the government had been warned of a possible terror attack on the mall. The inquiry team recommended all Somali refugees living in Kenya urban centres to be taken back to the camps, and those in the camps to be taken back to Somalia. What followed was months of security sweeps flushing out Al-Shabaab adherents, sympathisers and illegal immigrants. Even after the operation arresting thousands and deporting hundreds, Kenya has continued to witness grenade and gun attacks, especially in Lamu County in the coast region that borders Somalia. Franklin notes nothing has changed and the country's security agencies are faced with the same old challenges.
The introduction of the Kenya Defence Forces domestically again and again since Westgate, to no seeming effect, the fact that Lamu County is under curfew, I would suggest that these signs all indicate nothing has changed since what we saw at Westgate, particularly on Saturday, the 21st of September, when everyone seemed to be waiting for orders about what to do.
Kenyan police spokesman Masoud Mwinyi agrees some mistakes were made, but says now they are working hard on how to improve and to deal with any terror threats.
What has come out strongly is that we need to do things more better. We were able to sit back and evaluate our performance, see what we did right, and also try to look at what we could have done better. So in a nutshell, we have tried to work strongly on our response capacity. How can we respond quicker than we did before?
1 year on, Kenyans are yet to come to terms with the horror that happened at Westgate. But more than ever, most people feel unsafe and feel their forces have failed to protect them. Mohamed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
Zimbabwe's Minister of State for Manicaland Province, Christopher Mushwe, has threatened the remaining white commercial farmers. He says their property will be seized if they do not share their knowledge with and provide technical assistance to black farmers. Mushwe threatened the commercial farmers in Chipinge District, where he was the guest of honor at a recent field day organized by banana producing company Matanuska at the Chibowe and Mutema irrigation schemes. Reporter Lloyd Hamoyu has the story.
Mushwe, who was guest of honor at a field day organized by banana producing company Matanuska at Chibowe and Mutema irrigation schemes in Chipinge, said government wants the few remaining white commercial farmers to work closely with resettled farmers and engage them on outgrower programs. He said he was impressed by Matanuska project because villagers will be able to produce and export their produce to foreign markets. Mushwe said commercial farmers should back the government's empowerment initiatives through supporting their neighboring black peasant farmers with knowledge and finance. The remaining white commercial farmers who are into timber, potato, seed, and dairy production, he said, must not be disturbed. Mushwe added, the country cannot continue to import milk from South Africa, adding Zimbabwe needs to boost production and export. Disturbing the remaining commercial farmers' operations will also affect the economy, he said. Matanuska, a private firm from Malaysia, assisted Chipinge District farmers on an outgrower program to plant a 60-hectare banana crop, which they say has improved their livelihoods of at least 500 families. The families have since 2009 been growing bananas for the Malaysian company, which then exports to meet growing foreign demand. Mushwe said it would be wise for commercial farmers to help their black counterparts grow through technical expertise and in the process ensuring their produce also finds its way onto the international markets.
We'll be calling on them to make sure they help new farmers and villagers, especially those around here producing milk. Otherwise, they will lose their land. Of course, we will lose the milk, but they will also lose the land. We want to share knowledge with our people.
Working together, he said, would ensure the commercial farmers get to keep their land. Mushwe also appealed to non-governmental organizations to chip in and assist communal farmers to grow good quality crops for the export market. Mushwe said Zimbabwean farming could grow if farmers with the ability and expertise worked well with the new black farmers, adding those who do not heed his call may live to regret not assisting neighboring communities.
Those who work well with us and our people in the small-scale farming areas and the communal areas,
then we have somewhere to start from. Those who do not want to empower others cannot have any guarantees whatsoever.
Matanuska, in partnership with the Zimbabwe Aid, has also resuscitated the two communities' derelict irrigation schemes that had been destroyed by Cyclone Eline in 2000. This allowed the banana project to come to fruition. Currently, over 60 hectares of land is under banana production in both communities, and the farmers are harvesting 60 tons of banana from each hectare every 9 months for the export market. The farmers working on the project say they are living better lives now, finding it easy to pay school fees, build better houses, and related needs. Mathias Jokwe, a beneficiary, says they harvest after every 9 months and get an average of $2,500 per farmer. Adding to date, they have had 3 harvests. Another beneficiary, Agnes Piri, says now she can afford doing things she never could afford before the banana project. Matanuska Project's manager, Johannes Makurumidze, said the company intends to empower more farmers by expanding their banana producing capacity. Reporting in Mtema, Chipinge West, this is Lweda Moyo.
Pickup Artists South Africa is the first company in Africa to offer a service that in the last decade has seen success in the developed world, training men to attract women. Pickup artists, or POAs, are men who consider themselves skilled at finding and attracting potential mates. There are associations of them around the globe, with many being in the United States. While women's rights groups have slammed the so-called seduction community as sexist and even misogynistic, POAs defend their rights to live good and love life and deny abusing women. Darren Taylor reports.
Dramatic music begins the video link on the Pickup Artists South Africa website. A kaleidoscope of electronic color lights up a sea of people in a nightclub in Johannesburg. The camera focuses on several attractive young women. One runs her fingers through her platinum blonde hair, her sublime figure emphasized by a tight white dress. A blurb emerges on screen. It says, develop the tools and techniques to attract any woman you desire.
Back in school days, I was never great with girls. I always liked and loved girls, but it was never really reciprocated.
Ryan Pima, an unassuming young man, is one of the brains behind the company. He and partner Josh Margolis are South Africa's first professional pickup artists. They've been mentored by the world's best. In a chic bar, they explain how they hold boot camps for men who want more success with ladies. During 2 nights of theory, Pima lectures clients about how women... This is followed by a few practical evenings at bars and clubs, where students interact with women under the guidance of pickup artists, including Margolis.
This is tough. Mentally, physically, emotionally, this is draining. This isn't for sissies. The guys that come on this, they deserve to be applauded.
On the website, clients praise the benefits of the boot camps.
This boot camp helps people to actually find what works for them.
The knowledge I acquired here was absolutely amazing, mind-blowing stuff. Well, I think I've learned definitely how to approach girls.
I really think that the course is worthwhile doing. And it really does work.
The PUSA bootcamp has completely changed my life.
Margolis insists that success, according to his teachings, isn't necessarily about having sex with women.
You get guys that are really, really struggling with women, and for them, just talking to a girl, that is success, my friends, okay? Every guy comes on the bootcamp with their own incentives.
Margolis adds, though, that many of his clients are now in stable, long-term relationships, like one of the first men to sign up for boot camp about a year ago.
He actually met his girlfriends going out as a pickup artist, and they ended up getting engaged. For me, that's far more rewarding than a guy just taking a girl home and sleeping with her. You know,
Pima emphasizes that he and his partner don't teach men how to manipulate or deceive women.
We're not teaching guys these superpower techniques that are going to eliminate all women's freedom of choice so that they are completely seduced hypnotically. It's not how it works.
How it actually works, says Pima, is simple.
That was Darren Taylor reporting from South Africa on Pickup Artist from Johannesburg. And coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, the Saturday music spot from our collection of music from the continent, then we'll have commentary by Dr. Suleiman Nyang, Professor of African Studies and Comparative Politics at Howard University. It's now time for our Saturday music spot, so sit back, relax, and enjoy.
Dance, 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 dance nasima bololo ekomilo kolo santa apreku boyani olingo de paradiso nasima ekomia fe okomiko banga banga sinte plena sokiwana. Pasia pamba, o coma o regrete, o colela la pamba, o comesa nani pote. Bolingo ne basi wiza, esa la cama wate. Soki embeti yo fimbo, apre ku paboyo. Kolinga moto etumbo, ebandeli ba plaisir. Omi pesa komi oboya, nana ke na bulungani. Soko munga minanute, oko simba limalate, oko funa pamba pamba. Oko luka ba raison, ba kondi me la yote, oko pesa nani pote.
Ha, Papa Noel, o yurumba de lengi, Kini, Havana.
David Masson, et je n'y vois rien. Ça me tombe beaucoup croire.
And that was our Saturday music spot. Hope you enjoyed it. Now, the commentary by Dr. Suleiman Nyang, Professor of African Studies and Comparative Politics at Howard University here in Washington. Good evening, Dr. Jonah.
Hello, Africa. It is always a pleasure to take full advantage of the opportunity to address African opinions on and attitudes toward the United States. While simultaneously looking at U.S. policy towards Africa. Every week, I pay close attention to the headlines and see how we can come up with a narrative about American-African relations. What is now very much in the news is Ebola, and Ebola and the American experience. Liberia is a very important part in the American-African relations. Liberia's relations with America goes back to the slave trade. And the United States forces that were committed to abolition in slavery in the United States saw Liberia as a place where they can get free blacks to settle. And one good evidence of that legacy of President Monroe was the fact that today there are thousands, if not millions, of Africans who call themselves Americo-Liberians. And that was the legacy of Monroe and the abolitionists who wanted to put an end to slavery. And, of course, this was before the end of slavery. And today there are many prominent people who are now linked to that narrative. One of the nephews of George Washington, Baruch, was part of that narrative. Today in Washington, D.C., the legacy of someone with aspirations for the handicapped and the disabled Americans was very much involved with that movement. And today, Gallaudet College or University, right next to the Capitol, is one of the legacies of Gallaudet and his contemporaries. So Liberia's history is very much linked to love, good people, people who have vision in the United States. Today, when we look at President Obama and his legacies, and the manner in which President Obama's legacy is now very much linked to Africa willy-nilly, I have made the point in many places that Obama has outwitted history. Today, his legacies are going to be linked to the legacies of Monroe and a whole number of Americans who were involved in the founding of Liberia. And if you cross the Atlantic, you go to Liberia, there are thousands of families in Liberia today who can trace their roots back to this history. So now Ebola has become a new development. It did not originate in Liberia, but it has affected the lives of Sierra Leoneans who have parallels with America because the Sierra Leoneans were very much linked to British colonialism. And, of course, their journey to Africa was by way of Bermuda, Bahamas, and Nova Scotia. That's how the Sierra Leoneans were not affected by Ebola. But their histories and the histories of the Liberians are connected. Today, one disease is beginning to connect the dots between the United States, American scientific and technological know-how, and these African countries that are now witnessing Ebola. It is very striking that President Obama has decided to act on some of the suggestions of many people who are saying, in order for him to have impact in Africa, he has to call on American technological know-how to transform African society. Today, the Center for Disease Control and all the American military people can be involved in Africa in a humanitarian way, as opposed to the way many people who are very critical of America used to say that America was sending drones. And they were sending all these military people across Africa in search of terrorism. This time around, the terrorist is not a human being. It is part of our biological system, a disease that is more deadly in bringing out the end of life to many people. So when you talk about America and the end of life narratives, you can see how some of the American scholars who have looked at Death Watch, which was a book written by C. Scott Combs, which addresses the American theme, technology and end of life. If you read a book like that, with regard to how some of the American thinkers were focusing on American theme, technology and the end of life, you can see that this phenomenon of Ebola brings the American destiny and the African destiny together. Today, America must demonstrate beyond reasonable doubt that to the center of disease control and the experiences of the military who lost many people in Vietnam, learn a lot about tropical medicine. That knowledge should be used for the building of meaningful bridges between the United States and Africa. And if it is done well, Obama's legacy is going to be linked to the legacy of Monroe and the rest. And that's the way it is today.
Thank you very much, Dr. Ngang. Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English service of the Voice of America. From the rest of the Nightline team, managing editor William Eagle and producer Douglas Impuga, as well as our engineer for today, Richard Smith, we thank you for joining us tonight. I'm Peter Clotty. Good evening, Africa.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry recently visited Egypt in an effort to advance both countries' common strategic interests. Top among them, the fight against the barbaric terrorist group known as ISIL, or the Islamic State in Iraq and Levant. As an intellectual and cultural capital of the Muslim world, said Secretary Kerry, Egypt has a critical role to play in publicly renouncing the ideology that ISIL disseminates. Secretary Kerry said Egypt was on the front line of the fight against terrorism, particularly when it comes to fighting extremist groups in Sinai. Egyptian security officials say they face a threat from the Sinai-based Ansar Beit al-Maqdis, Egypt's most dangerous terrorist group. The U.S. continues to support Egypt's campaign against the Sinai-based terrorists, who have killed scores of policemen and soldiers. That is why the U.S. announced last month the intention to move forward on the delivery of 10 Apache helicopters. Egyptian Foreign Minister Sameh Shoukry said Egypt supports all international efforts to fight terrorism. And we support these efforts, and we will take all measures that are intended to eliminate this phenomena altogether. The best way to eliminate the ISIL threat, said Secretary Kerry, is by building a global coalition that will offer broad support to the Iraqi government, including military and humanitarian assistance. This coalition of nations must also find ways to stop the illicit funding streams that support ISIL and the flow of foreign fighters. At the same time, it is important for Muslim leaders, both political and religious, to speak out and repudiate the gross distortion of Islam that ISIL is spreading. Almost every country, said Secretary Kerry, has an ability to play some kind of role in this fight against ISIL and to join this coalition one way or the other. And we are committed to working with nations in every corner of the globe to push back against terrorism. The goal, said Secretary Kerry, is to degrade and ultimately to defeat ISIL wherever it exists.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.